This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new film Of Gods and Men won the grand prize at last year's Cannes Film Festival. It's based on the true story of seven French monks in Algeria who were kidnapped by Islamic insurgents and later found beheaded. The film is set in a mountain village in Algeria in 1996 during a civil war in which Islamic insurgents are fighting the military-run government. The monks belong to the Cistercian or Trappist order and spend several hours each day in silence and several hours singing prayers together. They're also working with the local villages and run a medical clinic. When the Islamic insurgents demand that all foreigners leave the country, the monks must decide whether to stay with the villagers, knowing they will likely be killed, or to flee. Much of the movie is about how the monks arrive at their decision. My guest, Lambert Wilson, stars in the film as Brother Christian. Wilson is well known in France for his many roles in movies and TV shows. He starred in the first French production of the Sondheim musical, A Little Night Music. His father, George Wilson, was also in many films and directed the National Popular Theater. In America, Lambert Wilson is best known for his appearances in the Matrix trilogy and Catwoman. I talk with Lambert Wilson about Of Gods and Men. Lambert Wilson, welcome to Fresh Air. Why were these monks, the monks that you and the other actors portray, why were they in Algeria?
They went to Algeria for different reasons. My character had a complete passion for that country. He was in Algeria as a little boy. He was raised in Algeria, and then he went back to France, and then he returned to Algeria when he was in his 20s during the Franco-Algerian War in the 50s. He chose to go to this small abbey to be a monk. Most of them had a passion for their cause, which was to help the local villagers, to help them read, to take care of them. This little abbey was in the middle of nowhere, and I think you have to remember that this is an order that is very strict, in which people, monks, speak as little as possible. They work, they pray, they sing. And I think it was a sort of an ideal place for them to do these things as well.
What did you do to get into character? I read that you lived in a monastery for about 6 days.
Well, first of all, we read a lot of material that's written about these monks. So there was all this documentation that we could absorb. And then the first step was to go to a retreat in one of these monasteries in France, in the French Alps. The director decided to split the group of actors in two groups, so we were four and four, and we spent a few days observing the monks, eating in silence with the other people who were going on the retreat. That was the first contact with the monastic life. And then we started singing, and that was really the best preparation. We learned Gregorian chanting, we learned liturgical singing, and that was the cement of the group. This is really what got this group of French actors together. We took a lot of lessons with a specialist. And
why did you need a specialist? What's different about the kind of chanting and singing that you had to do in your roles as monks compared to what you've done on CD and on stage and musicals?
Well, it's very specific. I think the director and the producers wanted the actors to be as close to the real thing as possible. And there is something very specific about the rhythms of this singing, about the use of the voice. You know, it's you don't use vibrato like you would for a musical or for an opera. It's something that's much, much cleaner, much purer, and that's what they were looking for. And also we had to sing in harmony. We had to learn and memorize all these chants. And we had to find among ourselves, among actors, is the sort of the unity, the melting of the voices, the sense of elevation that you get together, and which has absolutely nothing to do with theatrical singing. It's something completely different. And that did it in a way. I mean, because after that we were on the set and we put on our habits and that was it.
When you say it has nothing to do with theatrical singing is about communicating something to the audience. And this kind of singing is about a way of being in the world and a way of just communicating with the other monks, a way of finding unity with God and unity with the monks.
Exactly.
And, and calm within yourself.
It's about merging. It's about merging towards something bigger than yourself. It's not about performance. In fact, I had to, how can I say, turn myself down. I wanted, as any trained actor, I wanted to have the most beautiful sound. I wanted to. It was very difficult for me at the beginning not to perform, not to come up with these sounds. And but that was the best training because we communicated. And in fact, we loved it so much that on the set, we would sing in the middle of waiting, let's say, for a scene to be lit. Normally, actors go and have a cigarette. You know, they go and play cards, or you know, they go on their cell phones. No, we would gather and sing. We would sing all day. In fact, we would sing on the set. Suddenly, we would embark on this. Chanting, and it was extraordinary.
Let me play one of the hymns from the film so we can hear what you're talking about. And this is during the part of the film where the monks are deciding whether they're going to stay or go. They know their lives are in danger if they stay, and their lives would probably be in danger if they left, because getting out would be very difficult. So this is the translation. It's sung in French. This is the translation that's given in the American version. Like parched earth, I stand before your love. O Lord, hear my prayer. Listen to my cry for mercy. In your faithfulness, answer me. Enter not into judgment with your servant, for no man living is righteous before you. The enemy persecutes my soul. He has smitten my life to the ground. He has made me dwell in darkness with those long dead. My spirit grows faint within me. My heart within me dismayed. Answer me quickly, O Lord. My spirit fails. Here's my guest, Lambert Wilson, with the other actors playing monks in the new film of Gods and Men. And Lambert Wilson is leading the chant. You'll hear him sing solo lines and then the monks joining in.
Comme une terre assoiffée, me voici devant toi, Seigneur. Comme une terre assoiffée, me voici devant toi, Seigneur. Seigneur, entends ma prière, dans ta justice écoute mes appels, dans ta fidélité réponds-moi, n'entre pas en jugement avec ton serviteur, aucun vivant n'est juste devant toi. L'ennemi cherche ma perte, il foule au sol ma vie, il me fait habiter les ténèbres avec les morts de jadis. Le souffle en moi s'épuise, mon cœur au fond de moi s'épouvante. Vite réponds-moi, Seigneur, je suis à bout de souffle. Ne me cache pas ton visage, je serai de ceux qui tombent dans la fosse.
That's Lambert Wilson and the other actors playing monks in the new film of Gods and Men. Have these hymns stuck with you?
Oh yes, they have. When I hear what I've just heard, I'm immediately back in the little chapel where we were performing, filming, and some of them I really love. For instance, I went back after the film to the monastery where I had gone on a retreat, and I was so happy to be able to sing with the monks. I was so thrilled because some of them I love like one would love pop songs. I just my favorite is the last one that monks sing in the evening, which is a hymn to Mary, and which is the only one that is exactly like in the Gregorian tradition. It's sung in Latin. All the other ones are sung in French, but this one is sung in Latin, and it is so beautiful. So I was extremely happy because I had the impression that I'd become a bit one of them, in a way.
Would you mind singing a little bit of that just so we could hear it?
Oh, my God. Salve Regina, Mater Misericordiae, etc., etc.
That's really beautiful. There's a scene, and I hope you don't mind my talking about the scene, because it's fairly deep in the film, but there's a scene after the monks have decided to stay.
Mm-hmm.
And Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake is playing on their record player. And the camera just goes from one monk's face to another. Very long close-ups. By long, I mean a long period of time on each face. And you see this mix of emotion on each of the monk's faces, this mix of, I think, like acceptance, a feeling of being, that they soon will be kind of closer to God, but there's also fear. There too, there's happiness in being united together, to be one with the other monks, but uncertainty about how this will play out. So every face, all of the faces of the monks are such interesting faces. And that's one of the things that makes this scene so interesting, because just watching these faces, let alone the expressions on the faces, is interesting. Can you tell me what it was like for you to film that scene, knowing that you had to register very profound thoughts on your face, but without kind of, you know, playing it, making it broad?
Well, at the time, we were not performing anymore. And that's the very odd thing that happened with the actors and our director, Xavier Beauvois. This was one of the last scenes we shot in the shooting schedule. So I think we'd reached a level of acting which was not acting anymore. We all felt what we had to do. And I'm not saying that to sound interesting, but I think that's really what happened. At the same time, the director left the camera in front of each actor in a close-up for a very, very long time. And I remember when the camera was on me, I had to emote and do all the emotions in the world for about 6 minutes, going from fear to compassion to anger to love to, and at the end I didn't know what to do anymore. And he was relentless. He would just keep that camera in front of your face.
So I don't know if you were ever a religious person, if you spent time in church at all during your life, but has making the film changed you at all in terms of your religious or spiritual orientation?
I think it has. I think it's made it more crucial, more present, something of every day. I've always been fascinated in a way. Since I was a little kid, I was always been fascinated by churches. My parents were completely non-clerical. They hated priests, and I did not have a religious upbringing at all. But I remember when I was a little kid, I asked my neighbors in a little village in the French countryside to take me to Mass one Sunday, because I wanted to see what it was like. And then I was very frustrated also because I didn't study catechism when I was a little kid. And also I was not baptized. My brother was baptized, but I was not baptized. And so this has become an obsession with me throughout my childhood, adolescence, and early years as a man. And so I became I baptized much later in my life.
How old were you?
I must have been about almost 40, or between in late 30s. And I was baptized by a wonderful, wonderful man, a priest whom I had portrayed in a French film. His name was L'Abbé Pierre, Brother Pierre, and he's a man who took care of the homeless, very famous in France, who's dead now. So he baptized me, and it was extraordinary. And so I've always been attracted by those questions. I've always had a huge difficulty with dogma and religion, but I've always been strongly drawn towards spirituality and all those questions.
So I'm thinking it'd be interesting to hear you sing something secular now, since we've heard you sing a beautiful hymn. You have an album called Loin from 2007, and the songs on this are all French songs. And did you write the songs on this?
I wrote one lyric. I mean, well, for one song, yeah, the lyrics for one song.
Okay, I'm not sure.
To my great shame.
I'm not sure if it's the one I chose, but this is.
Let's hope not.
This is a favorite of mine. I don't know what the lyrics mean, anyways. My French is just not good enough. So this is "Toi, c'est trop."
Uh-huh.
So you tell us what the song's about, and then we'll hear it.
Well, it's all about three is too much for tango. Meaning, it's all about. A couple that is not a couple anymore, but a trio, and so this man is saying it's three is really too much.
Okay, so let's hear it. So this is my guest, Lambert Wilson, singing from his album Loin.
Trois c'est trop pour le tango. Et de ce quelquefois trop, y a deux tables de la loi, y en a que deux, pardon, pas trois. Mathématiques. Trois c'est trop pour le tango. Ça ne vous gênait pas trop, ce coin d'enfer. Du côté des chiffres impairs, comme il y a ne plus savoir qu'en faire. Encore bravo. Y a deux Irlandes, bientôt plus qu'une. Y a qu'un champion à la une. Bien sûr, y a qu'un seul amour pour les deux qui sont pour. Trois c'est trop pour le tango. Et deux c'est quelquefois trop. Oh, oh.
That's my guest, the French actor Lambert Wilson, who is now starring in Of Gods and Men. And I should mention not long ago that you starred in France in the first French production of Stephen Sondheim's musical Little Night Music. I should say I like your singing a lot. And,
thank you. I'm an absolute fan of Stephen Sondheim's. I've done
too.
Little Night Music.
Yeah.
It's the second time that I do Little Night Music. I've changed characters. I did the first one at the National Theatre in London, and then this year, well, last year at the Théâtre du Châtelet in Paris. We're going to do that again this summer in Italy in the Spoleto Festival. And Little Night Music is such a beautiful, beautiful, perfect piece. I was happy that finally Stephen Sondheim was performing in Paris because it was long due and
why did it
take
so long?
Huge success. I think it's because the trouble is that people try to translate him and you cannot translate Sondheim so because the words are so cleverly placed on the music. And so finally this wonderful theater in Paris decided to put on a Sondheim show without translating it, just with quick subtitles, and that was that. So that solved the problem. And also because we don't have a tradition of musical comedy. We don't have the theaters that can put them up, and we don't have the same musical culture. We are a country of operetta, and we are a country of rock. And we don't so much have the tradition of musical theater.
Now, your father, Georges Wilson, was a famous French actor and director. He was the director of the I'm sorry for my pronunciation here, Théâtre National Populaire.
Very good.
Which was the National Popular Theater is how it translates. And he directed that from 63 to 72. What was the importance of that theater?
Oh, huge. It was like the national theater with another one which was much more classical called the Comédie Française. But the National Popular Theater was, first of all, it had a huge auditorium and it had a wonderful repertoire of avant-garde plays of Bertolt Brecht that my father directed a lot. And it had a company. It had a company of excellent actors. And then it finished in Paris when my father left. But when I was a kid, going to the theater when my dad was a director was extraordinary. I mean, it was I meet a lot of people now who tell me, or people in their 50s and 60s who tell me that they were always going to the. We used to call it the TNP, that they would always go and see plays, and because it was a repertoire company for also a lot of classical writers, and it left a very, very strong imprint, I think, in the French mentality.
And I should say some Americans may have seen your father recently in the French movie Mazarine, based on the real life of a French gangster, but your father played a millionaire who's held hostage.
Yes, he's done a lot of cameos throughout his life. I mean, he did a lot of films, but his life was really in the theater. He before he became the director of that theater, he was the assistant to the man who was the director. So my father could only do cinema in the summer when he wasn't at the theater, and so he must have been in about 100 films, but I think his frustration was that because of the space that theater took in his life, that he couldn't really have a great career in films. That was a big tragedy in his life.
When you were growing up and going to the theater with your father, when he directed the theater, did he tell you that the theater is a very special place and that you had to behave in a certain way there?
He was very ambiguous. At the same time, he took me to the theater. He took me to the summer festival in the wonderful town of Avignon in the south of France. He did everything he could to give me a taste of this profession, of this world. And at the same time, when I was 16 and a half, and I had auditioned in a drama school in London, he refused. He would not subsidize me. He was extremely violent. He was extremely adamant that I didn't have it in me.
That you weren't good enough?
Yeah. That what he said was interesting. He said that I hadn't suffered enough as a young man, that I didn't have strong enough motivation to. An adolescent during the war, he had to take revenge on the world in a way. That was his motivation for becoming an actor. He wanted to take revenge. It was a very strong drive, and he was worried that my drive was not strong enough.
I should say the International Herald Tribune described your father as a difficult man. Maybe that's the kind of thing that they meant.
Yes, I mean, he was a very, how can I say, authoritative
authoritarian,
yes, and dictatorial man, which I think most directors are, and when they're not, you have to worry a little bit. And he was known for his angers, and at the same time, he was a very subtle and sweet man. He was very complex.
So when your father told you that you didn't have it in you to act, you hadn't suffered enough, why did you think he was wrong?
Because I knew what my suffering was.
What was your suffering? What was your suffering? You tell us all.
I think I was feeling very... ill at ease within myself. I was extremely shy. I felt very embarrassed all the time. I was blushing the entire time. One looked at me and I was blushing. And so I think my suffering came from my lack of comfort within myself. It was very strong.
Is that a kind of suffering your father understood or that even counted for him?
No, not at all, not at all. I mean, he didn't see it at all because he wasn't there anyway to witness those moments of lack of confidence. But at the same time, as I said, he had done everything he could to give me the virus of theater. Because if you don't want your son to become an actor, you do not invite him to go to a summer festival and to carry spears in a play, which I did for him. Because, of course, it goes straight to your head, as it did to me.
So you studied in England, which I suppose is why you have such a command of the English language and...
Not this morning.
No, you do. So, but when you arrived in England, could you speak convincingly?
When I arrived in London, I thought I understood everything, and I did not. So for about 6 months, I didn't understand what anybody said, basically. I was trying to imitate others. The first day of the first term, when the principal of the schools addressed us... I mean, I simply didn't understand a word he said. I had auditioned in French because they quickly realized that my English wasn't good enough, and so they shifted to French. And it was a catastrophe. I mean, I wasted a lot of time, and I was too young anyway. I mean, imagine being in a drama school at 17. It's so young. You don't know anything about life. And it was a method school of all techniques. So, therefore, a school in which you're supposed to bring your own experience to the character that you're performing. And I had none.
Well, that would probably have reinforced what your father said. You know, you haven't suffered enough. You don't have enough
True.
Experience.
Well, I certainly suffered in England because it was a very tough school. It's an interesting school, the Drama Centre. It's a school in which people like Piers Brosnan and Colin Firth have been trained. It's a combination of the method school a la Actors Studio and at the same time of more traditional English education and a lot of emphasis on the body, dance, but it was known to destroy people. It was known to for young actors to need 5 to 10 years to rebuild up a sort of an ego.
So you went back to France. You ended up doing a lot of French films. But I read, and tell me if this is true, that you auditioned in 1987 to play James Bond in The Living Daylights?
I can't remember for which Bond it was, but yes, I did the whole thing.
What is the whole thing?
Well, the whole scene is... It's a scene with a woman in bed. That was from Russia with Love, and then another scene with stunt guys doing a big stunt scene. I remember the girl was Mariam Dabo, who did the part in the film, and that's something that I would pay a lot of money to see. Oh my God!
The audition scene.
Oh yes.
Go ahead.
Now, I had to say the famous line, "My name is Bond, James Bond." Perhaps it was impossible, and you cannot have a French Bond. My name is Bond, James Bond. I think probably they were dreading that. So now I can only play a bad guy in a Bond film.
In bed, in the bed scene in Bond, did you have to have this, like, ultra confidence?
Yes. But you know what? I think my tests were not so bad because I remember they wanted to know all my whereabouts for a couple of months. And I started thinking, am I going to be James Bond? Does it mean that wherever I go in the world, I'm going to be James Bond? And it really scared me. And I was almost relieved that I didn't get it because the possibility of being... known in such a famous character throughout the world was actually pretty terrifying.
Right. So, you know, I have to ask you, earlier we were talking about when you were shooting Of Gods and Men and the kind of stillness you had to express as a monk and the long close-ups that were on your face. I don't remember this ad, but I know you did one of the one or more of the Calvin Klein Eternity ads.
Oh my God!
and I have to say, I think of those ads, the ones I remember, and I'm not sure if you were in any of these, of you know a face on film or a photograph where it's like, I am so handsome, I am so handsome, I love myself, and you will love me too.
Well, did you see them? Because I haven't seen them.
I don't know that I've seen yours, but I've seen this was from the 80s, right? Or the 90s?
Yes.
Yeah. I just remember some of those ads. It was just like, you know, there seems so much like vanity expressed in them.
Well, I think the commercials that we did for the first series of Eternity were actually much more bizarre than that. It was directed by Richard Avedon, and I was with Christy Turlington, and it was much more about Ingmar Bergman than about being a vain actor saying, look at me, how gorgeous I am. We were in a room, and we could never touch one another, and the room would change, you know, film after film, the room would take the colors of different seasons, and the lines were extraordinary, because I remember I had to say to her, would you still love me if I were a woman? Which was, that was really difficult to say. And but they didn't work. Calvin Klein, I think, hated them, and they disappeared really quickly.
That's so funny.
Unfortunately.
So your father, who discouraged you from going into acting, directed you in a film in 1988?
Yes.
What year was it? 89?
Yes.
So what was it like to be directed by him after him telling you not to even bother to act?
Well, it was wonderful because he knew me very well, and so he knew what to get from me. And I must say that every time he directed me, I was good. He was very proud to obtain a good result from me, and because every time he would see me in a play or a film, he would say that it was nonsense, that it was terrible, that I was terrible, that it was very badly directed. But finally, directing me, he could say, well, I've got the best out of Lambert. But it was an extraordinary experience to work with one's father being directed by him. I think we said everything that we could between a father and a son while we were working. We were very shy and modest during the rest of the day. But when we were working, we could say everything. And I think it's a treasure to have had that experience with one's father.
What could you say when you were working that you wouldn't have said otherwise?
Everything I could say. I could speak about our lives together. I could speak about my mother. I could speak about... It was because it was all material for a performance, in a way. But the wonderful thing is that I directed him, and that was really my tour de force, really. A couple of years ago, I directed Bérénice by Racine, and I asked him to be one of the characters, and he accepted, and I directed my dad. And that really, really completed the loop. It was extraordinary. For me.
Did he accept direction from you?
Well, It was hard. It was extremely hard. And I had to be very strong, especially I had to be very strong in front of the other actors, because he wanted to take power. He was so used to directing actors that he would just tell them what to do. And I had to keep on telling him, Dad, Dad, no, no, I'm the director now. And it was tough. It was really tough, but it was beautiful. And that's one of my few subjects of pride, that production.
I know your father died recently at the age of 88, and that he worked until the end, which seems like so wonderful. But I always feel that no matter how old a parent is, no matter what your relationship was, it affects you in ways that you're completely not prepared for. If you know when they die, and I've read that you had a very difficult time afterwards.
Well, I lost my mother and my dad within a year, and I worked solidly. I did Of Gods and Men and another film, The Princess of Montpensier, which is going to come out in America. I did Little Night Music. I directed a play, and then I lost it. I think it was a combination of not having fully allowed myself to live the mournings of both my parents and the sheer exhaustion of having been overworked. I completely collapsed. And it's taken me 6 months to recover. I'm fine now, but I was really, really not so well a few months ago. I think it's because I didn't have time. So I treated those issues as a formality, as a almost like one does a job. You know, okay, now I bury my dad, then I move on the following day to rehearse. Well, something within you, something very deep within you, takes a revenge, and it certainly did with me.
When you came out the other end, did you feel like you had to make changes in your life?
Inevitably. And those changes took place without me wanting them to happen. They'd simply happened. I couldn't accept the same difficulty of work that I was used to before. I mean, doing two leads in two films, a musical, comedy, directing a play, all that in 8 months is simply something that I can't do anymore. That I will not do anymore. I think it's given me the priority of life, of quality of life, of being with the people that I need, that are good for me, much more. Yes, it's changed my life.
Well, Lumber Wilson, it's really been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry.
Lumber Wilson stars in the new film Of Gods and Men. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews the new album by songwriter, singer, and guitarist Teddy Thompson. This is Fresh Air. British singer-songwriter Teddy Thompson moved to New York City to write and record the songs for his new fifth album called Bella. Rock critic Ken Tucker says that the result is a romantic album that spans an impressively wide range of styles and moods.
Well, you and I were meant to be.
Thompson sings in a keening tenor voice that registers as confident and strong. Then he writes songs about what a weak, flawed, even weaselly man he can be. This contrast is the key to most of the songs on Bella. On the song that opened this review, Delilah, he speaks of having to get out of his own way to open himself up to a happiness that he complicates unnecessarily. A bit later, on Over and Over, his first-person narrator says he criticizes and ridicules himself so that no one else can, that isolation is a comfortable place, and that repeating myself cuts the fear. To strip these sentiments from the songs, you'd think you were in for a lot of mopiness. Instead, Bella is bursting with wonderful pop songs, such as its lead-off track, Looking for a Girl.
Smokes. It takes a lot of work, but can take a joke. What does this girl of mine hide herself away? Whoever she is, I hope she's on her way. I've been looking for a girl. I've been looking for a girl. I've been looking for a girl who knows how to love me.
Looking for a Girl, with its surging chorus and clever couplets about looking for a girl who turns my bread into buttered toast, could pass as a hit on American country music charts and reminds you of this British singer-songwriter's affinity for early rock styles. His third album, Up Front and Down Low, was a collection of country music covers. And on the new album, I Feel has a Buddy Holly, Everly Brothers approach to melodic harmony.
Well, it's gone.
I've made it through three songs without mentioning that Teddy Thompson is the son of Richard and Linda Thompson. Certainly, one way Teddy has distinguished himself from his parents is by stressing his singing over his guitar playing or songwriting. I suspect that's what's behind his continued emphasis on American songcraft as well. Still, he doesn't shy away from his status as the son of folk rock royalty. He's played in his father's band, in Roseanne Cash's band, helped write much of his mother's 2002 comeback album, and has performed with other music family siblings such as Rufus Wainwright. On one of the best songs on Bella, he performs a duet with Jenny Muldaur, the daughter of Maria and Jeff Muldaur. That song, Tell Me What You Want, is cast as a lovely back and forth between two lovers dancing around their mutual desires and needs.
Baby, tell me what you want. I'll do anything you want.
I want a love that can be true. Someone who loved me through and through.
Baby, I can give you that. No problem.
Moving across the attractive surfaces of Bella is a fog of regret and free-floating melancholy. The word or name Bella never appears on the album, although Thompson has said in interviews that it's the name of someone he was once close to. The album feels like the chronicle of a man coming to terms with missed opportunities for an intimacy that only drives him deeper within himself. This would be a self-indulgent downer had Teddy Thompson not transmuted these sentiments into something lively and beautiful.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Teddy Thompson's album, Bella. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, Lauren Krenzel, and Heidi Simon. I'm Terry Gross.